This is Kimberly Atkins-Store, senior opinion writer and columnist at the Boston Globe and co-host of the Politicon podcast, hashtag sisters-in-law. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the first full week of April, and this week, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson became the first Black woman confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Three Republicans joined Senate Democrats to confirm Judge Jackson. We already knew last week that Maine Republican Susan Collins would cast her vote in her favor, as did Alaska Republican Lisa Murkowski. Utah Republican Mitt Romney called her a, quote, well-qualified jurist, even if he didn't expect to agree with her on every decision. But he and his fellow Republicans also torpedoed a $10 billion COVID relief deal Romney himself helped to broker because Chuck Schumer wouldn't include an amendment to continue immigration restrictions that President Biden plans to drop next month. So let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. I'm your guest host and your center, and I'm joined by Washington Post columnist Megan McArdle on the right. Hi, Megan.
Hi.
And on the left is Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. Welcome back, Liz.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I want to start with Megan. Were you surprised to see the three Republican senators cross the aisle and say they would support Judge Jackson's confirmation, particularly Mitt Romney, who voted against her when she went before the Senate last year for her spot on the D.C. Circuit?
No, I'm actually not really surprised. I mean, look, I think that there is a shrinking center that believes that presidents have a pretty broad latitude to install the justices that fit their ideological priors. And Romney is among the, you know, there's a very narrow range of moderates, but they are there. We've seen this before with Collins and Murkowski crossing the aisle on earlier judges. And I think it's not really a surprising development. I think it is heartening that it's still happening when there seems to be in so many ways so little scope for bipartisanship. It's obviously sort of distressing that we can't have more of it, but I'll take what I can get.
Yeah, and a couple points that come to mind to me. One, I think, and my colleague at the Globe, Renee Graham, made this point in a column very well, I think. We need to stop calling three Republicans out of 50 bipartisan. I mean, it's really not. That's a really split, you know, that's like saying if you put a drop of ice cream in a soda, that's a float. It really isn't. And if that's the measure that we have, then it really doesn't hold people accountable to do what I think is their job, which is if you have a qualified candidate before the Senate's job is to advise and consent. And unless there is something disqualifying about the candidate, it's their job to vote yes. And the second point I have about Romney in particular, you know, I've covered him since he was at the State House in Massachusetts, and he's always done what was politically right for him at the time, right? That's why he called out Trump before he buddied up to Trump when he thought he might be Secretary of State before he voted to remove him. I feel like this is the same. He is from Utah. He's popular. He can cast this vote, which I think is on the right side of history, and not really face the same kind of political blowback as others. Liz, I want to give you a chance to weigh in here, too.
I mean, I'm glad that the nomination went through. I mean, if anything else, it's just a return to, I feel like, the normal run of things. When people voted for Biden, I assume this is what they were looking for, which is essentially an executive branch that works without them paying very much attention to it or getting very invested. And that's what's happening.
So, like Romney, Lisa Murkowski also praised Judge Jackson's judicial qualifications, but she took aim at the process, saying, quote, her confirmation vote, quote, rests on my rejection of the corrosive politicization of the review process for Supreme Court nominees, which on both sides of the aisle is growing worse and more detached from reality by the year. Liz, do you think that she's right? Talk a little bit more about that.
I mean, it's certainly true that as things become more and more polarized, you know, especially under the sort of era of McConnell, you've seen Republicans more and more willing to just 100% stonewall, going back to the Obama era, you know, anything the president's trying to do. I mean, I think we all remember the Merrick Garland fiasco. And then, you know, Democrats, if they have any sense, you know, should be willing to do the exact same thing, although, you know, often just have lacked the numbers. During Trump's presidency, of course, he famously got Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett on the bench, but the Kavanaugh confirmation process was extraordinarily, you know, fraught. And I imagine that's what she's referring to.
And I mean, even Gorsuch, right? He got a 54-48 vote, right? This is not something that only Republicans do. Democrats vote their party line on this. And I think that that's really a symptom of a terrible way that we have come to think about the Supreme Court. I would argue that this started on the left, this idea of the Supreme Court is a kind of super legislature where, you know, when you talk to people, especially on the left, you see some of this on the right, but the right tends to have a more arguably, you know, kind of convenient theory, but a coherent theory of original meaning and so forth. When you talk to people on the left about what unconstitutional means, to them, what it means is things I think are really important. So abortion is a constitutional right, not because it's in the Constitution in a kind of meaningful way that people who didn't want to find it there could see that, yes, that's there. But it's there because the left thinks that's a really, really important right that should be protected. And so, you know, I think that has been going on for decades now. And for a while, this worked as the kind of one weird trick that wouldn't let conservatives do a bunch of stuff they wanted, like outlaw abortion. And then conservatives caught on. And now what we're locked into is a fight over getting control of, instead of getting control of Congress, because Congress doesn't do anything, is to get control of the super legislature so that you can just install justices who will just rule without having to get the consent voter buy-in or do any of the messy negotiations. Just, you know, get 5 out of 9 people and you can have what you want. I think that's a phenomenally terrible way to think about democracy, something that I think the left has belatedly woken up to because conservatives now control the court. But it should never have been this way. It shouldn't be this way with conservatives. We should not be thinking about this as a way to say, argue that there's a 14th Amendment right to, you know, that abortion is like the right to not have, you know, to be protected from abortion, that a fetal right is in the Constitution. That shouldn't happen either. That in fact, the questions that are really hard should be left to the messy, unsatisfying, difficult process of democratic negotiation through the legislature, rather than trying to put those questions beyond politics, because they never are beyond politics. And what we're doing instead is politicizing a body that really shouldn't be.
Well, whatever the case, however we got here, whether it was the left or the right, it can't be reversed by thinking about things differently, right? Because the left didn't, whoever discovered that the Supreme Court could be captured, they didn't like re-theorize it. They just discovered a fact, which is that this is a super legislature. They can actually just, you know, pretty much unilaterally and undemocratically change the laws. And that's just what they are. They're an elite, undemocratic governing body. That just is a matter of fact. That they have political views is also true. This has been true since Dred Scott.
I would really disagree with that, though. And this is not to say that earlier...
I don't know, but it's true. It's just a fact. Do they change laws or not?
Well, let me make the argument. It's not that I would argue that the Supreme Court never made political decisions, right? Obviously, Dred Scott is up there in the list of really bad decisions. But I think that there was a kind of legal theory revolution that preceded this, was that there was, in fact, a push in law schools first that then fed into the court of expanding wildly beyond what had historically been the role of the courts, making it bigger and bigger in order to do things that the law professors thought were really important. And they weren't wrong that those things were important or that the courts could be used to do that. But I think that without that permission structure, in fact, the courts would not have done these things. And we did change.
Let me ask a question and then we can get back to this, because we're talking about, we're saying that this has happened for decades. The Supreme Court has been interpreting the 14th Amendment to provide constitutional rights in unenumerated ways for a very long time. Yet, we have only seen this lack of bipartisanship fairly recently. Antonin Scalia, who is the founder of the Federalist Society, was confirmed unanimously. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who came from the ACLU and whose entire career was about advancing women's rights, was confirmed nearly unanimously. It took some decades later and a lot more politicization from the Senate to get these sort of straight down the middle votes, except, I'll put an asterisk, except in the case when a candidate was accused of serious wrongdoing, because I think that takes it the confirmation in a different direction in the cases that that happened. So even if what you're saying is true, how do we get to a point where we stop the Senate, and what it sounds like you're talking about, from politicizing the court? Is it the Senate politicizing the court or the court becoming political? I would argue that it's the former. I'll let you go first, Liz.
Well, so, you know, my view would just be that they're the three branches of the federal government, and they're all political. Even when you had like Roger Taney saying that people of African descent, free or enslaved, could never be United States citizens, right? This is in Dred Scott. This is a guy making a political call, right? He also says the Missouri Compromise is unconstitutional, so the federal government has no authority to stop the spread of slavery. I don't know what that sounds like to you. To me, this is someone intervening politically as the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court way back before the Civil War even. And so that to me seems like probably the number one example of, you know, the Supreme Court always functioning as a kind of elite political body, not just this purely interpretive body.
Megan, I want to give you one last point.
I want to push back on that. So look, I need to preface this by saying these decisions were bad decisions and the Supreme Court made them the wrong way. But the Supreme Court is in an area where the Supreme Court actually does have to rule, which is you have a conflict between state laws. And the Supreme Court's job has always been, and kind of inherently needs to be, what do you do when you have two sets of laws that where states are making claims against each other? So a question like abortion, right, that is actually not something where I think you have to say, well, these states have claims against each other and the Supreme Court needs to resolve them. Supreme Court should have resolved the claims over slavery the other way. They should have said, no, you like obviously slavery bad, right? No, you cannot follow your fugitive slaves into the North. In fact, I would argue that they should have found a constitutional right, right? But, you know, that we should have, there are a lot of things that we should have done about slavery. Anyway, I'm going to leave that aside.
All right, I'm going to put a pin in this just for a moment because I don't think we're going to come to a point of agreement here. I would like to maybe find a place where we can agree. One of my favorite moments living in Washington, D.C., when I do, was in 2008, after a very bitterly fought presidential campaign. I ran into a friend of mine who I do not agree with ideologically, but we both could agree on the fact that the election of the first Black president was really a proud moment that we could all say and enjoy. I hope at the very least this week, wherever everyone falls, we can take a moment to say a Black woman on the Supreme Court after 108, I believe, white men is something that is good. The court should reflect our society. And with that, we're going to move on and talk about COVID relief. So Megan, Mitt Romney made news this week. The deal he worked on for a $10 billion COVID relief package was meant to pass quickly, but it hit a snag when Senate Republicans wanted to include an amendment that keeps Title 42 in place. That's a policy that restricts immigration at U.S. land borders out of public health concerns due to the pandemic. Biden plans to lift that next month. So what do you make of this hiccup? Are we about to have another fight in Washington over immigration?
I think that we're going to have fights over immigration because the question still hasn't been resolved. And I think that part of this goes back to what I was saying about super legislatures and so forth, is that we're trying to resolve questions rather than in Congress where stuff has to be negotiated and hammered out. We're ultimately resolved a lot of these questions by executive orders or because there was a pandemic and now no one wanted to argue about whether we should have immigration. But the question is still there. How many people should we let into the United States? And that's not actually a question, honestly, that either side has ever really addressed, where you have everyone kind of trying to dance around and argue about procedural stuff, but no one just answering the really fundamental question, How many hundreds of thousands, millions? How many people do we want to let in every year? And what sort of people? Should we be doing family reunification, higher skilled immigration, or lower skilled immigration? There are many possible answers to all of those questions. But until we settle those questions, until we actually have that argument, we're not going to get anywhere.
Liz, I want to give you the last minute in this section to respond to that. Also keeping in mind that we may also be seeing Ukrainian refugees more arriving here too. What do you say about this immigration issue?
It's certainly important that the United States take in a number of Ukrainian refugees that we currently haven't committed to. I think at this point, our commitments are in the hundreds of thousands. I've heard from President Biden, 100,000. I know states have come out and said that they're prepared to take many more than that. And I think that we should certainly be looking at much, much, much higher numbers than just 100,000.
I'll be back with Elizabeth Brunig, Megan McArdle, and Daniel Dresner from Tufts University will join us as our special guest for a conversation about Ukraine, the United Nations, and war crimes. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
This is Left, Right, and Center. We're changing things up, but always keeping it civilized yet provocative. Let us know what you want to hear or who you want to hear from. You can ask a question or leave a comment at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr, columnist for the Boston Globe. On the right is Megan McArdle from the Washington Post, and on the left is Elizabeth Brunig from the Atlantic. All eyes have been on the Ukrainian city of Bucha, just outside Kyiv this week, after evidence emerged of indiscriminate civilian killings. The images are horrifying and heartbreaking. Bodies in the streets, many of them with their hands bound behind their backs. President Biden called what happened there a war crime, and he imposed tougher sanctions on Russia's largest banks and Vladimir Putin's adult children. The Kremlin says the pictures are a, quote, monstrous forgery designed to smear Russia. I want to bring in our special guest, Daniel Dresner, into the conversation now. He's a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, Kimberly.
First, I just want to get your just raw reaction to what we learned about what happened in Bucha.
I would agree with the one thing I would agree with the Russian statement is that it is indeed monstrous. It is in no way a fabrication. There have been multiple confirmations. We've seen reports from both Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. We've also gotten intelligence from, I believe, the Germans, the British, and the Americans, confirming that this was clearly an attack propagated by Russian forces and was in no way staged. So it's absolutely horrifying and will therefore probably lead to, as you pointed out, additional sanctions. And any sense that perhaps there was any sort of flagging enthusiasm for isolating Russia, I think clearly has come to an end. And we can see this most recently in the eviction of Russia from the Human Rights Council, the UN Human Rights Council.
So, Dan, I want to talk about these sanctions and other actions, but to me, it seems that we can't talk about a response, really, until we understand what Vladimir Putin is trying to do and what it would take to make him stop. What does that tell you about what Vladimir Putin wants? Would just a piece of Ukraine, for example, if that could be negotiated, would that be enough to stop him, or would it only empower him to do this again? What should the United States and NATO be trying to get Vladimir Putin to understand in order to make him stop?
I think you have to recall that in some ways this is round two of what started in 2014 when Vladimir Putin decided he wanted to annex Crimea and foment a frozen conflict in the Donbas. I think we have to be honest here. What Vladimir Putin wants to do is extinguish Ukrainian nationalism. He wants to extinguish the Ukrainian state. He wrote a 10,000-word essay over the summer trying to explain that, in fact, the whole idea of Ukrainian statehood is a fiction invented by Vladimir Lenin. While military exigencies are going to probably prevent him from being able to completely run over Ukraine. He clearly does not want an independent Ukraine to exist. And to paraphrase something Zbigniew Brzezinski said back in the 1990s, Russia without Ukraine is a country. Russia with Ukraine is an empire. And what Vladimir Putin wants is to resuscitate the Russian empire.
Mm. And when we talk about the increased sanctions now, can they be effective in stopping him? It sounds like there really isn't, it's not like there's a middle ground that you can negotiate to.
Right. So let's be very clear. On the one hand, the sanctions that have been imposed against Russia are significant. They're not crippling. I mean, you know, the European Union is still sending literally hundreds of millions of dollars to Russia every day because they're buying Russian oil and natural gas. That said, the harshest sanctions in the world are not going to force a great power to give up territory that is it expended blood and treasure to try to acquire. So in that sense, sanctions alone are not going to accomplish much of anything except to weaken Russia. The question to ask is whether the sanctions in concert with intelligence assistance to Ukraine, military assistance to Ukraine, and Russia's depleting ability to actually launch an offensive does eventually sap the ability of Russia to physically do what it wants to do. And that is where sanctions actually can play a role. They are going to weaken the Russian economy. They're going to make it very difficult for Russia to actually resupply its forces after a certain point. And that is the level at which you sort of have to think about the sanctions. If you think of sanctions as the ability to compel Russia to back down, they're not going to work. If you think of the ability of sanctions to weaken Russia's ability to do what it wants to do, then they're going to be effective. And then the last thing I would point out here is that this isn't just about Russia and Ukraine. This is also about other great powers that, let's say, rhyme with China, that might be considering taking actions in an irredentist territory that rhymes with, let's say, Taiwan.
So on Thursday, the UN General Assembly voted to suspend Russia from the Human Rights Council. 93 voted in favor, 22 against, 58 abstained. I want to bring Megan and Liz to this to get your reaction to not only what we've seen happening in Bucha and beyond, but the UN General Assembly vote. I'll start with you, Megan.
Look, I think that this was much deserved. I'm not sure it's going to be particularly influential. Part of the problem, right, is that by the time you're doing what Russia did in Bucha, you're probably not that worried about what the UN Human Rights Council thinks. But, you know, the symbolic gesture is a good thing to send, not necessarily so much because of the effect we expect to have on Russia, but because it has an effect on us. It says, you know, we define who we are and what we don't do. And that is always, with things like this, a very good message to reinforce.
Liz, your reaction?
Yeah, I mean, you know, very similar thoughts. I think it's right to the degree that you can disavow and to some degree penalize war crimes. I think it's difficult for the international community to do that, especially when you're trying to avoid provocation. But right, I'm not exactly enthusiastic that it's going to have any kind of impact on Russia.
Dan, one thing that this vote concerns me about, particularly with some of the abstentions, it reveals the influence that Vladimir Putin has had beyond Russia in a way that can help insulate him a little bit, at least give him more breathing room. Maybe it doesn't matter in terms of this vote, but is that something that could matter in other ways?
I don't think it's that big of a deal. I mean, it's worth remembering that the UN General Assembly is not usually considered friendly territory for the United States, whereas it is considered somewhat more favorable territory for countries like Russia and China, because Russia and China explicitly pursue policies where they often extend aid or other carrots in return for UN General Assembly votes. So it is unsurprising that you had the number of votes for abstentions and that you had the number of votes with Russia on this issue. That said, it is still worth pointing out that over 90 countries voted to eject Russia from the UN Human Rights Council. And the other thing that should be remembered about this is that a lot of the countries probably abstaining or voting for Russia are doing so not just because of Russia, but because of their own human rights atrocities and or human rights transgressions. And so partly there is some discomfort at, yes, what Russia is doing is undeniably beyond the pale, but there are plenty of other countries that have also done some appalling things, including to, let's say, Western journalists, and yet they have not necessarily gotten to the UN Human Rights Council.
Well, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky made an impassioned speech before the UN this week, really taking the Security Council to task. He called what happened in Bucha and elsewhere in his country the worst war crimes since World War II. He urged the Security Council to remove Russia as a member so it can't block decisions about its own war. By the way, the only way to remove Russia from the UN Security Council would be if Russia agreed to it, which it won't. And the only way to kick a member out of the UN is if you amend the charter, which you can't do unless all five permanent members of the Security Council agree. Dan, you see the problem here. What do we make of Zelensky's speech? Is it in any way practical?
No, it's completely impractical. And it's worth remembering that one of the reasons why you have something like the Permanent Five in the UN Security Council is precisely because you need to have some recognition of the fact that there's an unequal distribution of power in the world. And so the only reason you're going to have countries like Russia and China, and for that matter, the United States, willing to work within the UN is with the understanding implicitly that they have some degree of veto power. So we're basically seeing what's happening at the United Nations now. I'm old enough to remember how the United Nations Security Council operated during the Cold War. And that's what we're going back to. We're going back to the notion that the UN Security Council will be unable to do much of anything with respect to policing great powers because those great powers will always veto action at the UN Security Council. And when countries in, let's say, sub-Saharan Africa or Southeast Asia or Latin America complain that they are being unfairly singled out where great power actions are being neglected, they're right. That's the cold, hard realities of the United Nations. Now, you can say, well, let's get rid of the United Nations then and create an entirely new system, except that entirely new system would still have to have this recognition. And so this is the world we live in the sense that there is no perfect global governance structure that would handle something like Russia unless you want genuinely a world government, and most people don't.
I want to talk a little bit about how we got here. Dan, I want to talk about your piece in the Washington Post this week, in which you essentially argue that the modern Republican Party, since Trump's rise, cast out all the hawkish neoconservatives. And you wrote that, quote, "National conservatives have met their own version of the war in Iraq." Explain that. What did you mean?
Well, it would be safe to say that neoconservatives who were riding high circa 2001 to 2003 under the Bush administration, were the strongest advocates for invading Iraq with the idea that doing so would set off a democratic revolution in the Middle East, and also that one of the more famous quotes that Dick Cheney gave, that U.S. forces would be welcomed as liberators in Iraq. That clearly did not happen. There have been a whole variety of knock-on foreign policy effects from that, all of them negative for the United States. And as a result, particularly within the Republican Party, once Donald Trump rose to prominence, neoconservatives who were appalled by Trump opposed him and continued to oppose him even after he'd been elected president. As a result of that, you saw the emergence of some attempt to foster national conservatism as an alternative philosophy. The idea that it's a foreign policy founded more on restraint, that we don't necessarily care what goes on in the domestic affairs of other countries. And indeed, in the more Trumpy parts of the party, there was even this adulation for illiberal populists like Viktor Orban in Hungary and Vladimir Putin in Russia. And prior to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, a lot of national conservatives either argued, well, Russia's not really going to invade Ukraine, or if they are going to invade Ukraine, that's due to NATO expansion, so it's really all our fault. Or most importantly, Russia will quickly defeat Ukraine, and therefore we just should accommodate and learn to live with this and so forth. And in the 5-6 weeks that have transpired since the war started, their predictions have not necessarily come to pass. They have tried to claim that somehow the United States will be risking World War III if we do things like impose sanctions or provide arms to Ukraine or so forth. And by and large, they're not making a ton of sense on this. I mean, they're obviously correct to warn about the risks of over-escalation, doing things like imposing a no-fly zone in Ukraine, except that is also the position of the Biden administration, so it doesn't really make the national conservatives at all distinctive. And
Dan, I want to pause you there just for a minute, just because I want to give our panel time to respond. Megan, you go first.
I co-sign things that Dan says.
Yeah, dang.
Can you elaborate a little bit, Megan?
No, look, I think that the fact has always been that we have to recognize the realities of great power politics and where national conservatism has gone wrong. Like where national conservatism has gone right is in some ways in saying that and saying, like, you know, we're not the world's parents and we can't fix everything. And that was a much needed corrective to certain trends in the Republic, certain, you know, factions in the side of the Republican Party. But the unfortunately, they've done a thing that is really common among political groups, which is that it would be more convenient if the choices that you made didn't involve trade-offs. And so what you had with the national conservatives, right, is that what they wanted to believe was not merely that maybe we couldn't do anything very productive in Ukraine. I disagree with that, but I think it's a legit argument. What they wanted to believe was that, like, actually Ukraine is the aggressor here and that really this only happened because the United States has been doing stuff abroad. And if it hadn't been for NATO, like, all this would be fine. And, you know, as I said on Twitter, like, a couple of days ago, where they ended up in the position is, you know, the best time to have stopped apologizing for Vladimir Putin was years ago. But the next best time is before he commits more war crimes. And this is the kind of persistent problem they have had all along is they'll defend something and they'll be like, but, you know, and the assumption is always that, like, Vladimir Putin is now not going to do something even worse. And there's a lot worse still in store. And I think that this is something where they have to stop thinking the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And just recognize that, like, maybe their foreign policy position is defensible, but you have to defend it out of reality, not by trying to conjure some alternate world.
I want to give Liz a chance to get the last word in before our last break.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, as everyone knew when the advent of nuclear weapons came about, they would reset the way that international conflict took place completely, and they have. And the reason that the stakes are so high, the reason that there isn't more we can do and that the risk is what it is for any kind of intervention or provocation is because these are nuclear powers and there is a nuclear risk. And so, you know, if nuclear weapons were not in play, then my whole assessment of the situation would be different. But nuclear weapons are in play. And so there would have to be so much more at stake at this point for me to support American, you know, sort of direct military intervention on behalf of Ukraine against Russia that, you know, I just feel we're incredibly distant from that. So I remain, you know, outraged on behalf of the Ukrainian people. Russia's obviously the aggressor. Efforts by the right wing to paint this as like a Russian conservative sort of jihad against Ukrainian wokeness are funny and ridiculous and absurd. You know, will remain an artifact of this very weird period in modernity.
Dan, just lightning round question, yes or no. Are we actually headed to World War III? Are we all going to die in a nuclear fallout?
I'm going to say no, because if I'm proven wrong, well, really, how's anyone going to notice? But in all seriousness, no, I don't think so. And I think, you know, one of the things that the U.S. and EU response deserves credit for is they've obviously been willing to help Ukraine, and there's been a lot of assistance to Ukraine. It's also very clear that there are going to be certain red lines that are not going to be crossed. And I would also add that Russia has not crossed certain red lines in response as well, that they've certainly attacked Ukraine. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's Dan Dresner. He is a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, just outside Boston. Thanks for joining us, Dan.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Megan McArdle from The Washington Post and Elizabeth Brunig from The Atlantic. We'll be back with Elon Musk joining Twitter's board, a possible edit button, that's exciting, and a conversation about free speech. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
New year, new show. We're making changes to Left, Right, and Center, and you can weigh in. Leave a comment or ask us a question at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Kimberly Atkins-Store, columnist for the Boston Globe. On the right is Washington Post columnist Megan McArdle, and on the left is Elizabeth Brunig, a staff writer at The Atlantic. About a week ago, Twitter, well, tweeted that it's working on an edit button. That came on April 1st, so a lot of people viewed it with a healthy degree of skepticism. But then, on Tuesday, Twitter said that it is, in fact, something they're developing. And that comes at the same time the world's richest person, Tesla and SpaceX founder Elon Musk, had been appointed to Twitter's board. He's also the company's largest stockholder. So, Megan, I want to start with you. Elon Musk is a prolific tweeter, as we know. He's also been a big critic of the company for being too heavy-handed with the way it moderates content. Twitter said they've discussed having Musk be more active in shaping the future of Twitter. Not the day-to-day minutia, but big picture stuff. So what do you think? Is this a good move for the company? And is it good for what we think of as free speech?
Well, I mean, I don't think the company has much choice. It's sort of like saying, is it a good move to pay your taxes? Yes. They can't stop him from buying large amounts of corporate stock. And he did. And now they have to reckon with the fact that he's their biggest shareholder. I think that it's interesting in perspective to realize this is basically the equivalent for like a normal person of buying a flat screen television. It's about how much of his net worth this represents. And I think that he is going to take an active role. I presume that's why he did it. I think actually I would say that some of this is the fact that he's clearly been looking to diversify away from his fairly concentrated holdings in Tesla. But I don't think this is ultimately a play about the business future of Twitter. I think this is a play about the fact that Elon Musk likes Twitter. He sees it as a place that has a huge amount of influence, not so much because it has a lot of users. It doesn't compared to other social media services, but because of who the users are. It has a huge mindshare among journalists, something that it arguably is problematic. It has huge mindshare among people who follow journalists, influencers, politicians, and so forth. And so getting, you know, intervening in the company after what has been a tumultuous few years in which there's been a lot of controversy about whether Twitter's heavy-handed moderation policies are systemically biased against conservatives. He, I think, sees a way to get in and use some of that leverage that he has with his huge fortune to change a platform that he's clearly very fond of. And I think to change society to the extent that you can by changing Twitter policy.
Liz, I want you to react to Megan and also just throw in, does it matter who the person is yet? Yes, Twitter can't stop someone from buying stock. But if the person wants to do more than just be an owner, clearly want to have an active role into how Twitter operates, does it matter that it is Elon Musk, somebody who has used the platform in all sorts of ways, including altering the value of his own company? How does that make a difference?
It certainly could matter that it's Elon Musk if he wants to actually get involved, which I hope he does, because he could not help but destroy it. And it should be destroyed. Look, if I were a normal person who could operate in normal society, I wouldn't be a journalist, but I'm not. And so this is the industry I'm in. And I like chaos and problems. And I'm very excited that Elon Musk has purchased Twitter. I hope he immediately makes a bunch of very strange changes and super official tweaks that make the website difficult to use. And I hope he capriciously bans people and brands he doesn't like or is mad at, and comes up with all sorts of weird and draconian penalties for people he finds unfunny and boring on there. That's what the internet used to be like. And it was much better back in the day. And it would be really entertaining if he did that. So Elon, if you're listening, that's what I think you should do.
I'm sure he is listening. But listen, Twitter is not like the internet used to be back in the day, right? Twitter is a place where a lot of people...
No, it's worse.
But it's a place where people use to get their information. For better or worse, it's people use it to get their information. And so isn't this... shouldn't we be wanting, instead of advocating for the chaos that could bring it down, shouldn't we be trying to see if there's a balance that could be struck? I mean,
you can't wield it.
If you have unfettered, unfiltered, unmoderated forms of an outlet like this, then that's how you get all the misinformation and disinformation. If you have bad actors, though, in bad faith, using it for their own purposes, that's no good either. How do you draw the line? Liz first and then Megan.
I think that any platform where people are going to have any range of expressive capabilities is going to be prone to spreading huge blasts of misinformation and encouraging cantankerous interactions and polarization. I don't think you can wield it. I think, yeah, Elon Musk just needs to become Muad'Dib, the hand of God, and just destroy it, just end it. It would be so much better if he did.
Megan.
Well, I mean, I would point out that, in fact, not a lot of people get information on Twitter. As I say, this is a really weird platform where, like, a lot of journalists are on it. And so journalists think it's really, really influential. And there's a ton of people getting information here. But in fact, what it is journalists getting information about what other journalists think. And I would actually argue that in a lot of ways, that is, it does lead to groupthink and it's unhealthy. But we've all chosen to be on the hell site, so we can't really complain. I mean, I would also point out that where these sites have tried to moderate and prevent that disinformation, they have ended up sometimes spreading disinformation. Case in point, the Hunter Biden laptop, where Twitter not only refused to allow the sharing of the original New York Post story right before an election, they then banned the New York Post's Twitter account for sharing the story. And then it turned out that the story was true. And so, you know, when people say, well, oh, but there's going to be unfettered information, you know, you kind of have to wonder, and I think the complaint conservatives have that's not wrong, is that somehow the fetters, that all the errors tend to go in one direction, that in these things may be influencing elections, which is kind of creepy. And that, you know, who is the bad actor if you are, like, very nicely shutting down information that kind of discomfits your side? And so I think that in that sense, in fact, like, the credibility of the site and the credibility of the information, frankly, probably higher if you're not leaning in with this heavy-handed moderation, where we've now got a situation, sure, journalists trust Twitter more, but the people who aren't journalists, who look at it and see us making mistakes that all tend to go towards one side, trust us less and trust Twitter less. And so I think, in fact, like, I'm not that worried about Elon Musk unleashing disinformation. I'm actually much more worried about us unleashing disinformation and convincing ourselves that what we're really doing is protecting the world from disinformation.
Well, Megan, you had a whole Twitter thread this week about journalists getting off Twitter for good. Talk more about that. Make the case as to why we should all get off Twitter.
Well, for one thing, look, Twitter's a lot of fun. I've spent too much time on it, almost every journalist I know. And so I understand that this is, in some sense, a statement against interest. But I think this is a collective action problem. All of the journalists I know who have said, look, this thing it's fracturing my attention span. I can't read books anymore. I can't concentrate on anything longer than, like, you know, 500 words. And then my attention wanders and I have to go check Twitter. They are prone to groupthink, where all the journalists are watching all the other journalists. They're performing for the other journalists. They are, instead of for their readers, they're convincing themselves they're doing a lot of work getting their work out there. But in fact, Twitter doesn't drive a lot of traffic to most sites. Substack newsletters seem to be the exception to that for reasons I'm not real clear on. But in general, this is a thing that and you know, something I hear even from conservative editors, by the way, is that it's encouraging journalists basically to take a ton of reputational risks with the institution's reputation. So, you know, you can say these are my opinions, they're not the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal. But the fact is, if that's in your bio, and it is, people are reading you as being representative of that institution, but people don't act like they're in a public forum, in a public written forum. They act like they're talking to their friends in a bar, and they say stuff that's totally fine if you're talking to your friends in a bar, like, you know, people who drive the speed limit in the left-hand lane should be shot. Like, that's a funny thing to say at a bar at 1 a.m. But you sound, when it's stripped away from context and retweeted, you sound like a psycho. And then your employer has to account for the fact that you're a psycho.
Yeah. Liz, are you convinced? Are you going to get off Twitter?
No. I mean, I'm convinced it sucks, but I'm going to keep using it. It sucks for a lot of reasons. I mean, I don't think of journalism as a, let me put it this way. I mean, I spend all my time talking on the phone to like people on death row and going to executions and watching people get killed and stuff like that. So I don't think of this as a profession where I need to like straighten my tie and make sure that I seem presentable. I mean, it's pretty messy and dirty. So I don't worry too much about coming off as earthy on Twitter because I am, and what I do is as well. At the same time, Twitter does just completely suck. And like the reasons that it sucks are like instantly visible to the lay user. It just completely sucks. It sucks. At the same time, it's very funny and it generates a lot of good memes and people freak out on there and they do the funniest thing there is, which is acting weird in public. That's like the basis of all comedy. And so, you know, we'll all miss the acting weird in public, but that'll never come to an end. I think that Twitter is, you know, it's too much togetherness, too much communication, too much speed, too much stimulation. We turned all that up to the max and, it's not good for us as people. We need to turn it back.
I'll just leave it at as just give me an edit button so I can fix my typos, please, Twitter. That's all I ask. We'll leave it there. We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Liz, it's your soapbox.
I don't like the Easter Bunny. I just don't think it fits the vibe of Easter, for one thing. It also doesn't make any sense logically. So when you're trying to explain to your kid what Easter is about, if you're celebrating the holiday religiously, following that up with, and there's a bunny who I guess is like person-sized and maybe lays eggs. Like, is the bunny who hides the eggs? And if so, why? Where does he get them? Does he lay them? That's usually a reptile and bird thing. It's just confusing the kids. And they're not very bright to begin with. Just say you hid the eggs. I don't see what the problem is with that. When the kids are like, mommy, how did all these candy-filled eggs get here? I hid them for you, child. We're celebrating a holiday. Go find them and enjoy. We can just skip the whole weird bunny thing. It's such a strange lie.
Megan, what's grinding your gears?
I have spent a couple of weeks now watching progressives argue that Disney should threaten to move Disney World in order to pressure Florida to abandon the bill now known as the Don't Say Gay Law. If you're liberal, these conservatives will call it a parental rights bill, whatever you call it. It is ham-fisted and obviously not very popular with the left. But the left's taken the odd stance of trying to get Walt Disney, trying to get the Disney company to somehow undo this. This is a ridiculous idea. Disney World, yes, if they could threaten to move Disney World, that might well put pressure on Florida legislators. But Disney is the size of the city of San Francisco, and it is no more practical to say that Disney should move it than to say that you should move San Francisco to another state. The problem with this is not so much that some people have a dumb idea. It's that this is actually substituting for meaningful organizing at the local grassroots level, actually getting politicians to shift positions, actually persuading voters that this is a bad law. It seems to be popular in the state of Florida, which is why conservatives are pushing forward. Instead, over and over again, what you see is liberals, instead of trying to persuade people, try to use pressure points on major corporations scared of publicity in order to get what they want. This is not the road to anything, and it is certainly not the road to Walt Disney World, Atlanta, or in some other place.
Okay, for my rant, I want to talk about something that I haven't talked about much lately, which is sports. Specifically, the decision by the Boston Athletic Association to ban some Russian nationals from running in the Boston Marathon. That is a terrible idea for a host of reasons. One of them being that it's punishing the wrong people. We need to keep the eye on the prize, and that is Vladimir Putin and the oligarchs who support him. Also, by focusing on Russian nationals who have done nothing wrong in Ukraine, it only feeds into the very type of propaganda that Russia is using to try to peg the West as being anti-Russian people as opposed to anti-war crimes. Finally, sports is a place that is supposed to be about inspiring people, people coming together, and where we try to focus more on what joins us together. By using sports to make these rules, first of all, how do you even enforce them? I think if you start banning Russian nationals from sports here in America, the NHL is going to get real boring real fast, for example. But it's just short-sighted. Leave the foreign policy to those in charge of it. If the runners qualify, let them run. Don't punish them. They're not the messenger. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks to Elizabeth Brunig, Megan McArdle, and Daniel Dresner. Left, Right, and Center was produced this week by Brian Hardzinski. Our production assistant is Nisha Venkat. The show is recorded and mixed by John Meek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.